My name's Sandy Seberg, White Oak Farm. This picture is a picture of a farm that my great-grandfather bought in 1896, and it's still in the family to this day. My wife Mary and I farm in southeastern Wisconsin, so we're about halfway between Madison and Milwaukee, a little town called Stone Bank. For years, I was running an organic soil amendment business, compost and soil amendment business. Some of you might know Purple Cow Organics. I'm no longer owner of that business. And as transitioning into semi-retirement, we decided to take on a couple thousand acres of new land to transition for a local private foundation land trust. So my wife's not so crazy about that. There was a period of time where if people asked me, well, how many acres? Because that's always a question, right? And I never was, and still to this day, I'm not interested in becoming a bigger farmer, bigger organic farmer. I think it's really important that we have more farmers on farms, not necessarily this aggregation or larger farm. So I know sometimes bigger always seems like it's a goal or may or may not impress us, but we're 97,000 acres in Waukesha County of agricultural land. And since 1988, I was the only organic farmer that walked into the FSA office. So and I've tried to get other farmers to farm organically when people would come to me and say, you know, we really would like to not have the co-op driving by when our clothes is on the clothesline or the grandchildren or children in the yard. And for years, as I was running Purple Cow Organics, I had to say no to those people because we could really only conceivably farm about 400 acres. While still having that other job. So I haven't really been able to get, you know, these other farmers to transition. So our goal now is to aggregate this, you know, into what will eventually be about a 2,000 acre organic operation, and then hopefully split it back up into four or 500 acre operations and get some farmers on the ground. I showed you that picture. 1896, 1904 was the actual picture. You know, the other thing that I think is focused on potentially too heavily is multi-generational farms. I have nothing against somebody who's a fifth or a sixth or going on the seventh generation. It's phenomenal, it's necessary, it's important. But I think we also have to value and bring about an awareness and a possibility for first generation farmers. Because I'm actually, you know, I could either be considered a third generation farmer or a first, because there was a gap between my great-grandfather, grandfather, my father, where, you know, the farm was rented out and not as agriculturally active by family members as it's now returned to. So, again, we farm about 1,000 acres, you know, a couple hundred acres of pasture. You know, we picked up in the transition of this farmland, we picked up a conventional dairy that didn't have any cows in it. So we're running beef on about 200 acres of certified organic pasture. And we've got about another, it's actually about 700 more that's in transition right now. Used to grow a really wide variety of crops, partly because I wanted to diversify the workload, right? Spread it out with the other responsibilities I had with the business I was running. Plus, not being a big fan of crop insurance, I could de-risk if I only had 40, 50, 60 acres of a particular crop. It spread workload out with planting, it spread workload out with harvest, and it de-risked some of the, you know, if a big wind came through or whatever, those crops were some of them were insulated from potential crop losses or damages because of the diversity of the crops. That said, I'm, you know, with this desire to stay married after 40 years and simplify that crop rotation, you know, we've started to look at ways to still maintain and still live by the letter of the law as far as the National Organic Program, right? Continual improvement, improving soil, water, water infiltration, organic matter, nutrient cycling, all of those things that are so critical. But this is what transition land looks like for me. If you look closely in the very bottom center of that, you'll see a bit of a tire print. That was after an inch and a half of rain the day before, and they had 100,000 pound silage trucks driving on that field when they harvest that corn silage the day later. And that's that's the significance. In some areas of the field, the trucks weren't even leaving a tire print. That's how hard the fields are. So, you know, I'm trying to not disparage the farmer that was, you know, running 7 years of corn and 5 years of alfalfa in his conventional operation, but to some degree, that conventional farmer needed that ground condition because his custom harvester was coming tomorrow, whether he gained an inch and a half or not. And if he was going to get that silage off that field, and that field was as soft as it is now, his trucks would be stuck, and you know that would be a problem for him. So it's an interesting, you know, their systems approach is so different from an organic systems approach. It's just almost incomprehensible. There's, you know, I spent probably half an hour with a tiling spade trying to dig that hole. Initially, you know, I weighed 240 pounds. I was literally like a pogo stick bouncing on that tiling spade. And if anybody knows what a tiling spade is, it's only about 4 or 6 inches apart, right, or wide, you know, to try and get some sort of a lens as to what that soil profile might look like. So, you know, the thing that we're doing in these transition years is coming in with a ripper. Initially, we could only pull 3 shanks. And they were, you know, this field, that's that very same field that I showed you in the first picture. You know, we were breaking shear bolts, you know, snuffing out the engine on tractors. It was pretty amazing. But previously, we had taken an approach of using roots and rotation to break up these compactions. But that would take 5 or 7 years. I'm 66 now, and I don't want to spend that much time trying to turn a field around. So we go in with a mechanical alleviation, or what we feel is the best option for a mechanical alleviation first. You know, now we're, because of the acres, you know, I promised my wife I'd never go over 275 horsepower. Sorry, I lied. You know, we're running 500-600 horsepower tractors now, you know, and trying to get these acres covered. When I say I farm with my wife, she does all the books. She does 90% of the worrying, and I do all the work. So this is a 1,200 acre operation, you know, with really, other than a little bit of help in the spring and the fall from my son-in-law and my son, you know, I'm doing pretty much all of it myself now. But that's that same field. We, you know, we threw a quick cover crop in after corn silage coming off. And this is the what to me, at least in my life on other people's farms, in my purple cow days, as well as my own, is, you know, how quickly we can transform, you know, these soils by, you know, returning soil life and roots biology, root exudation, and all those things back into it. And we can actually do that faster, in my opinion, than I think was previously believed. But so this is what it kind of looked like in 400 acre days, trying to really build that rotation effect. You know, at the bottom you see the what would be a corn and soy kind of alternation, and then building out these really diverse rotations to try and you know, dodge weeds, manage fertility. You know, and there's been a number of workshops about, you know, trying to build these rotations. And I wanted to put this slide in because I did this for almost 30 years. You know, I believe very strongly in this. But for me personally, and in the context of our operation, I could no longer run 7-year rotations. I don't have enough bin space for the acres that we're running to have the complexity of the different crops. So we looked to simplify, you know, that crop rotation. So this is sort of what that rotation would have looked like. And, you know, we did a lot of cover cropping. We were, you know, trying to have, you know, no soil when we were tilling, was bare, and we had cover crops, you know, on every acre, post harvest of cash crops. And this is kind of what it looks like now, and the system that I've been working on and collaborating with Gary Zimmer is really looking at a way to. Use a very intensive, that rye year, you know, could easily be replaced with the terminology of a soil building year. The intention of that rye year is, number one, it's the only thing in the upper Midwest that we can plant after corn. You know, corn harvest for me with the changes in the weather. I mean, I don't know about any of you, but I've been coming to Moses Marble Sea La Crosse for a long time. And, you know, this was the first time I ever contemplated putting short sleeve shirts in my luggage as I was getting to come here, right? No frost, 60 degree temperatures. So there's things that are changing, but we're oftentimes not getting our corn off until, you know, between Thanksgiving and Christmas, you know, the last of it. And that's rye is the only thing that we can even remotely put out there as a seed with the intention that we're going to actually get a harvestable crop the following year. Obviously, with corn this year at potentially all-time low prices, you know, what are you going to plant this year, right? You know, what are you planting? You know, what are you growing this year? I'm growing older and crankier, right? The only thing we're planting really is rye. We planted half the farm into rye with the intention that the other half, I have not gone completely to no other alternative crops, but you know, we're basically doing that rye, frost-seeded clover, and then back to a row crop, utilizing that rye year as an intensive soil building year. We're meeting some of the increased pressure nowadays of, tillage has been demonized for a few decades now, but it's really becoming more into our wheelhouse as organic farmers of how are we going to reduce the intensity frequency of tillage. You know, in this system, you know, planting the rye in the fall, frost-seeding the clover in the spring, you know, mowing the clover and rye down, and then leaving that grow until the following spring leaves us with an 18-month window of no soil disturbance. This is what rye looked like in 1919, so a little over 100 years ago. Each one of those dots represents 25,000 bushels. So there was a tremendous amount of rye grown, particularly if you look at it, you know, in the upper Midwest, you know, which really has the ideal growing conditions, you know, even still today, from the standpoint of how cold it is and the ability, you know, to grow it on poorer soils, et cetera. This is a picture, Jimmy Emmons, big cover crop advocate out of Oklahoma. He was taking a picture of rye roots as he was out exploring in the field, probably preparing for a presentation somewhere. He obviously is in a much lighter ground. If you look at that, you know, he's in a sandier soil, but you know, all of those soil particles are held to those roots through the exudates, the mucilage, and the biology that is literally living in that rhizosheath. You know, and that's why healthy soil produces, you know, the aggregates and you know, these are the outcomes of positive soil health. But what he noticed when he was doing is that there, after he excavated that plant, there was an abandoned wormhole. And down in that wormhole was a rye root. And when I first saw this picture, it was Keith Burns. Anybody know Keith Burns? Green cover seed, probably, you know, pretty long-term, pretty well-renowned, you know, good experience in cover crops. And his belief is that rye probably produces the most amount of root exudates of any cover crop that would be available. And if you look at that closely, and I'll show you a picture even closer, you can see the drops of root exudates coming off of that rye root. So again, the agroecosystem service when we're planting this rye and going to this simplified system isn't to take away the diversity and the potential benefits. We're finding that by having this extremely intensive soil building year, we're not finding that we're having green bridges or disease problems. Some are alarmed, you know, are surprised by that, and certainly it's a reason for concern. But in the context of the farms that we're working on doing it now with, we're not seeing really any insect or disease problems with the system. So again, you know, I've simplified even the clover method for a while. We've gone back to a mix, but we've bounced around between diverse mixes so that we get different rooting structures of that clover blend. I chose for a while to go to a straight mammoth red clover, which is a single cut red clover, and I got it from a friend of mine who's about 1,900 miles north of here, so I didn't have to worry about overwintering. When we were doing some of those clover blends, some of those clovers come from Oregon and they come from the warm, you know, banana belt side of that state. And we were seeing some instances where they didn't really have the winter survival capabilities. And it could have been the competition of the other clovers. We've had other things that are happening, at least in this part of the world, where we're having open winters with 20 below zero weather, right? You know, so, you know, some of that overwintering problem, I shouldn't blame on the potential of it, where it was grown or what species or what variety it was. You know, we're having some interesting weather anomalies that are leaving us in a situation where, fortunately, in all those instances, even rye that's planted in December is remarkably surviving those open, you know, double digit below zero winters. So again, you've got the 18 months of zero soil disturbance. We chose on our farm because a customer was requiring it or requesting it to go through the ROC certification process. Anybody else here ROC certified? Come on. Regenerative Organic Certification. It's through Rodale and the Regenerative Organic Alliance. I was hesitant myself because I didn't want to be putting a potential brand or label or opportunity that said my organic is better than your organic. And that's not really the intent of it, but it is something that they're trying to use to market specific outcome-based, potentially soil, you know, primarily soil health and carbon-based measurements on farms that then consumer package companies can monetize. So I'm not as set on just the corn, rye, clover, corn, rye, clover, corn, rye, clover, because I have some other market options. You know, we have sunflowers, you know, we have sorghum, grain sorghum, you know, we have dry beans, so that we can plug in that. The system in my mind is really not only its simplification, but its ability to use the palates of these other crops in decision making, so that in a year like this, I don't have to, or at least I think I don't have to, potentially suffer at the market's mercy with low corn prices. As long as I have, you know, like sunflowers, you know, most of the sunflower seed companies are saying don't go back on a field of sunflowers within 3 years of when you last planted them. The old timer that taught me how to grow sunflowers said never before five. So, you know, again, some of those rotational effects or what you've had previously grown on the field are going to also determine your ability to go in or out. But if corn was still 950 to 1050, you know, it'd be back to that slide. You know, we probably wouldn't be thinking about at the, and economically we wouldn't have to be at a choice point, you know, to be looking at other crops in that scenario. So again, back to where we start at least. Now obviously we've got fields that are long-term organic fields that don't look like this. The other thing to remember a lot of times, and I've learned this myself, they say that, what is it, that the only person that doesn't make mistakes is the one that doesn't try something. But the reality is that, you know, when we're talking about, oh, I put 2 bushels out or I put 100 pounds out, the thing to remember is that rye seed in particular has a pretty significant variance. I don't know specifically what these varieties are. I got them from Phil Needham. But, you know, those varieties there vary between 10 and 26,000 seeds per pound. So when I say I put 120 pounds of rye out, we're pretty much consistently growing either Hazlitt or Ryman. You know, they're both relatively the same seed size. But if you're going to take any of these recommendations or from me or others, you know, you need to factor in seed size if you're going to try and calibrate that. You're basically looking for, depending upon how soon you're planting, the earlier you plant, you know, the less rye you need to put out there, the later you plant, and I've pushed that envelope, you know, you need to put more seeds out there because they're not going to tiller, and if you're looking at still getting some rye. So our system is to simply go out after corn. That's one of our longer-term organic corn fields, so it's not nearly as miserable looking as that silage field is, but we simply go out, calibrate the fertilizer cart, spread rye at 45, 50 feet wide, and come in. On the Zimmer farm, you know, they're using not a speed disc, but sort of a modified speed disc, you know, vertical tillage tool along with an air seeder. You know, I'd potentially like to get to that, but our system is working. And we also have, you know, larger fields there on contours and some things that probably have some different demands on their system. Do you have a question? The reason I haven't chosen to drill is because it's unnecessary. And the system that I had where we're broadcasting at 50 feet and speed tilling at 31 equates between those two passes at about 25, 26 acres an hour, and I can't drill that fast. You know, we're growing rye for seed. We do a lot of work with Albert Lea Seed Company, and been very fortunate for that relationship for the decades that I've had it. But you know, they take full truckloads, right? So if there is a partial truckload, that's the seed that I'm replanting. A drill requires some cleaning, usually. I can use bin run if I do a broadcast situation. So there's just a few efficiencies. And again, in context of ours, it's just, that's why.
How fast are you going, how deep are you going with that?
On the Zimmer farm, I couldn't say exactly how deep, but it's usually, in this system, all you want to do is manage the residue and just touch the soil, just so you're tickling the soil. You're not really doing a lot of tillage. Hit that particular picture, they're actually putting the rye in the air seeder and then making one pass. And again, Nick Zimmer's, you know, you think I'm crazy, 1,200 acres with one person. Nick's doing 1,500, you know, with one person. So. Yeah, so I'm broadcasting like this with, you know, bought it cheap at an auction fertilizer cart, and then coming back, I've got that slide right. So then we frost seed clover after that rye's been broadcast. But if we've got, yeah, so that so we've had 2 years where, I mean, the 2 years ago was the first year in, you know, my farming career that I ever had to replant corn. We had an extremely cold, we planted it, you know, last week of May. Should have been well beyond, you know, super cold rains and all that kind of stuff. Got a blast of frigid rain, you know, the day after planting. And the corn, you know, that really killed the germ on the corn, right? And then the corn came up kind of spotty, but it still wasn't like, I'm gonna take it down and replant, and then a week later we got hail, you know, and that made the decision for me. But so I set the stage for that because now I've got corn that's going in the 10th of June, and I've got skies that are dark from Canada. No offense against anybody from Canada if you're in the room, but Canadian wildfire smoke, and then cooler than normal entire summer, and wet, cool fall. And harvest, which I knew was already going to be delayed because of replant, is now pushed to, you know, a week or two before Christmas. And that particular year, 2 years ago, in our area, we went from 50 degrees 2 weeks before Christmas to 20 below, and then back up to 50s and 60s the second week of January with no snow. So I didn't have, from post-harvest, time to get out and broadcast rye until January 24th. And again, I said, you know, we're looking at this system to really test the boundaries. Most farmers would have given up. They wouldn't even have thought about broadcasting rye after harvesting corn the week before Christmas. We waited until the ground conditions were right, temperatures were there, and we went out and broadcasted rye, you know, the third week of January. And I've got some pictures I'll show you, but last year we did the same thing. Not quite as bad. It was January 3rd, I think, we planted our last rye.
Did that germinate?
Interestingly enough, this year, you know, we broadcast the last rye just before 18 inches of snow. There was no frost on the ground, and it germinated under the snow. But again, you know, we're using a tractor. Three-point spreader. We've gone to a little bit bigger, you know, spreader now. Two spinners and a scale on it, so that we can be a little more accurate. You know, clover seed's expensive, and you want to get it right. But you know, before that, we were using almost the same spreader that Nick's using. on the back of a four-wheeler, you know, and you know, we could get 100 acres done pretty easily before the ground got too mushy on a four-wheeler. Nick drives a little faster, you know, and I think he probably can get 200 acres done, you know, before the conditions get a little slick. But the clover is really more about calibrating and ensuring that your pattern and your spread width is there. But you know, if you're not overlapping too much and wasting seed and potentially causing, you know, too high a seeding rate, or worse, you know, having areas where there's skips, you know, however you develop that frost seeding system, it's pretty reliable and works really well. And the rye, that this is clover in the spring, obviously we're looking for that nodulation. This is what, you know, this is one of Zimmer's rye fields, but that's what the rye would look like in the spring. Maybe a little thicker than in some instances. Again, depending on if I'd have been planting earlier this year and we had the fall that we had, that's probably what the rye would look like, you know, in the spring. Go ahead.
So you do a plow down on the clover the next year following for corn?
Yep. You're getting ahead of me a little bit, but you're on the right track. So again, this is the field that was planted. I had Carl Dallafield from Prairie Creek Seeds was riding with me in the tractor when I was speed disking this rye in on January 23rd or 4th. But that's what that rye field looks like. Really good weed control. You can see on the foreground that there's plenty of clover coming up. This is one of the Zimmer rye fields. Again, looking very similar. Systems are similar. Soils are very different. Regions are different. So, you know, we always have to try and ensure that when you're looking at a slide like this or hearing somebody like me, you know, telling about a system that we're using on our farm, that you actually factor in the context, you know, of your own location and your own farm. This is what can happen if the rye does get too thick or if there's too much fertility. It's one of the reasons I think between lodging and ergot, which are more fear-based than they actually happen, you know, and there's hybrids that are coming out and there's other things to reduce the ergot problem. But you know, planting rate and fertility, you know, if that rye goes down like that, the bigger concern that I would have, and I think, you know, Gary and Nick would have, is what did that do to the clover underneath it? Because the rye is really there to nurse that clover crop. Because we're trying to grow the fertility on the farm, fix nitrogen from the atmosphere. You know, we're breathing air right now that's 78% nitrogen, and I have a hard time buying conventional poultry litter in general. Right? I mean, that's our, you know, Zimmer's are in a location where they not only ship their corn, they're vertically integrated. They ship their corn to an organic laying operation and get the litter back. That's a perfect loop, but not all of us are going to have, you know, that kind of proximity and access to fertility. Yes, Margaret.
So do you supplement
your clover seeding
with any manure?
No. No. So go ahead, Gary.
I was going to say that the reason why we're supposed to drill it, and then you see now we cut our seeding rate down, we bulk this, so it's not in the row, it won't compete with one of them, goes so tall and spindly. And see, that's we don't want that to really happen. That's all we're in the clover that made a rye. That's why the drill is cool. So we plant right after the day after we've got harvested corn, we're planting the rye. The sun's all alone. So we plant the rye in the morning before he starts combining, and the combining he did the day before. And that does this. We got some that's green and some that you can hardly see out there yet.
Right.
Today. He's planting today.
But again, you know, you can see how relatively thin, you know, that's not going to impress somebody that's just a cash grain farmer for rye, right? This isn't in rows, so it's a broadcast situation. Even if it's in that air seeder, that's coming out of seed tubes and being blown down on the ground ahead of that implement. So it's not getting, you know, and to your question about drilling, you know, that's probably another component that was factored into that I forgot at the time of your question. But Gary's right, you know, you put them all in a row. Not only do you outcompete the clover, I think Gary had an intern on his farm and they were looking at a field and they were like, why is the clover growing in rows? Well, it was because the rye had outcompeted the clover in the rye rows, you know, so it created that pattern situation in the field. So the broadcasting of the rye, the broadcasting of the clover offers this seed placement configuration that seems to be really working for us. Okay, so back to that January 24th, that was 120 pounds. If I'm back in December, it's 100. You know, if I'm in November, it's 70. So. Well, at 120 pounds, you know, if we're talking just pounds per bushel, right? Not back to the seed rate slide that I showed, and you're growing your own rye, you know, that's $20 worth of seed, you know. So, you know, I would rather, you know, put this. Right, right. So those seeds that we're putting out in January, or the later anyone would put a rye seed out broadcast like this, the less tillering, and potentially even the less of them are going to germinate, right? Some of them are going to be sitting on top of the soil, you know, or on the residues. They're potentially going to get frozen out because maybe they do germinate, but then cold sets in without any snow cover, et cetera, et cetera. So you're really just upping that seeding rate, you know, to insulate. I do it just to make sure that I get sort of that minimum, you know, of maybe 800 to a million, you know, 800,000 to a million live plants out there in this sort of spattered approach. We're not trying to get up to like that agronomic 1.5, 1.8, where we're thick as a hair as a dog's back. We're trying to go a little lighter.
And the other thing we're seeing this year, they really schooled out that warm fall. The stuff we planted early really schooled out. That there, right, at bushel seed per acre, 60 pounds, that went 60 bushel, that was up our best. But we punch them out, you do get a good ride driver. We're nervous with that lot until like forward. I can't sell all the ride we grow now.
So again, just trying to show the similarities of the system, and I'm going to get to some slides that actually show the economics at the end. But from a visual standpoint, I wanted to show you that, you know, even though we're in different regions, very different soil types, and some minor changes specifically as to equipment and implementation, you know, we're in that same rye grain harvest rate, you know, as Gary and Nick are doing on their farms. But this was late. This was December 7th. Some crazy stuff. So that's that same December 7th field, you know, the following spring and summer. But that's, again, that system, you know, this was a transition year. So that was conventional corn taken for grain. You know, we broadcast the rye on that crop residue and speed disked it in. And we're very comfortable if that, you know, yields 45, 50 bushels, you know, we really don't. And to Gary's point, you know, one of the reasons that Gary and I and a couple others have started a nonprofit called Rye Revival is to try and, you know, gain access to more markets and increase rye utilization, everything from cover crops to feed to human consumption. Because there's really, you know, not a market, you know, if it's probably one of the things I should have had on the wall or in one of the slides is like, don't go home and do this, right? I mean, do it on some fields, do it if you have neighbors that want cover crop seed, do it if you want your own cover crop seed. But this system is really about growing the clover and growing the fertility. And if I can't sell the rye, I'm not gonna cry. You know, it's just, you know, the rye is a bonus in those particular situations because we're very fortunate and we've been extremely active in trying to develop rye markets. And if anybody here knows of ones that we don't, you know, come up and talk to me afterward. But and we are seeing more rye milling. You know, John from Meadowlark Organics is sitting up here in front, and I think he's seen some modest increases in the demand for rye flours. But even with those increases and increased awareness, the benefits of this cover cropping, you know, beginning to take off a little bit across the country, there's, you know, if half of my farm and half of Gary's farm is in rye, you know, it's probably 50, 60,000 bushels of rye between the two of us, and that's a hard volume of rye to sell currently, you know, in some markets. So. Interestingly enough, and I'll show some pictures, but even in the fall when you see that clover after it's been clipped, the clover establishes so quick after that rye is up that we do not see, you know, unless it's a weird weather year or we've not been able to mow timely, you know, after we don't see a lot, other than bare spots. If you get some, you didn't do a good job spinning it on or something happened out there, you'll see some volunteer rye in those bare spots. But where the clover establishes as well, we don't see a lot of volunteer rye. And I say we, I mean, I've been on Gary's farm too, and he's not seeing it either. So that clover is frost seeded on in March, or, you know, I'll probably do it when I get home. The clover is actually growing simultaneous to the rye.
Once the rye comes up, it really
takes off.
Yep. Then you terminate that clover that same fall or spring.
We mow the clover once to take advantage of the nitrogen production. You know, putting that, you know, and I've taken some tests of that above ground clover growth. Gary's taken some. Again, different contexts, different fields, different base fertilities. But, you know, there's some pretty significant volumes of nitrogen, you know, based on the analysis of just the above-ground biomass, and that's what we're after. So letting it grow, you know, is into the following spring and terminating just ahead of corn. We'll get to those slides in a second. Good question, though. So, again, you combine. This is over at Otter Creek. That's what it looks like, you know, a little bit of clover, a little bit of weeds underneath the rye. Come in, batwing, mow it. Back to that same field again. I'm kind of proud of that January 23rd, if you hadn't noticed that already. I'm kind of amazed myself that it turned out this nice, so I wouldn't recommend trying it. But you're not going to really know what the bookends of something you can do and something that's crazy until you try it, right? I mean, but, you know, that's that field post-harvest, post-batwing mowing. You know, that was this last year, you know, and to get 45 bushels of rye off of that field in the worst drought in 15 years was pretty remarkable. Is that a pen up for a question, or? Yes, Margaret.
Could you go back to this slide where you got the rye down?
The rye lodged?
Yeah. No, not yet.
Oh, the harvest picture, this one? Margaret is an agronomist at Albert Lee Seed. Stand up, Margaret, and introduce yourself. Anyhow, yes, that we're really trying to just go in and clip the heads, not run as little through the combine as possible.
And so then, are you mowing it right afterwards?
Yeah, and I've been, as you and I have talked, Margaret, I've been a fan of the single, you know, so medium red clover in Canada is called double cut, single, or a mammoth red clover is called single cut. So I'd been on the mammoth red or the single cut clover with the intention of not only solving the concerns I had on our farmer's winter kill and buying this really hardy, very far north of here, Siberia grown clover, but also I wanted to only mow it once. So, you know, that we only mow once. And it really driven by if there's weeds and the conditions are such that it looks like we're going to get viable seed on any weed that escaped the clover and the rye, I'll mow potentially even prematurely to manage that weed situation. But the beauty of it is that when you know, that clover comes up and, you know, Purple Cow, we were in the composting business for 30 plus years. When you're trying to manage CN ratios, if you mow that earlier, you're putting down a lot of carbon and not a lot of nitrogen or nitrogenous legume clippings are mixed with it. If you allow the clover to grow up and then mix those two together, it sheet composts and breaks down quicker on the surface of the field as well. And, you know, people have told me, like, the tire tracks from the combine or, you know, the grain cart and all those kinds of things. It's amazing how the clover just, when you go out there to mow it, other than there's no standing rye stems, the clover looks consistent all the way through that.
And you're using the
batwing
mower for the
rotary
blade mower?
Yep, yep.
Does it matter?
Does it
matter if you use the stock chopper?
I don't know. I wouldn't think that a flail mower would be detrimental. I mean, I think it's really, with a flail mower or a batwing mower, you know, it's all about your desired outcome and the speed that you travel, right? If you grab another gear in either one of those two mowing situations, you're gonna have some crap look behind you, you know? So you gotta manage what are you willing to accept as far as the field conditions after you mow. And I like it, you know, I mean, I like that picture I showed you. This is how I like that field to look when we mow. I wanna make sure that I've done a good job of mixing those carbon, you know, composting. You know, so that I get maximum nutrient cycling, but that I also want to make sure that I've done extremely, you know, some of the weeds that are coming up are just starting to germ under the, you know, the clover was a nurse crop for a weed, right? So I, you know, they're hiding under there. So, you know, we try and get, we went from a 15-foot bat wing mower to a 20 so that my son-in-law wasn't encouraged to go faster to get it done. You know, he could stay going slow, you know? It depends. I got some rocky fields that I can't go much below 6, or I'll take a blade off the mower. It depends on where the clover's at. This is in the drought year, so I went pretty low, because the clover just didn't really rebound after rye harvest like it normally would. So to get that mixture of the straw and the clover, I had to take a little bit more clover than normal, lower cutting height. I would agree with that. Yeah, I think you've got to look at what's there, and you know, depending upon my weed pressure, and in some fields I don't have those weeds that are small, potentially stunted and being, you know, grown low because of the competitiveness of the clover, and I don't have to mow low. But the other thing about this system, I've heard numerous other talks over the years, you know, is by not disturbing that soil, you know, there's I think they're called granivores, right? There's field mice and other insects and animals that will literally use those high protein weed seeds and clover seeds and leftover rye seeds, and they'll go out there and consume, you know, 8-10 times their body weight in weed seeds, or, you know, left, you know, that might be part of where the volunteer rye goes. You know, field mice are eating it. I don't know, but it completely changes the landscape when you're working in these fields, at least on my farm, because the hawks seem to all communicate with each other when I'm out in a field. We had an old 1086 that we used to use for the batwing mower, and there was actually one time that a hawk flew sideways between the stack and the windshield and scared the daylights out of me as it was going, you know, for a bunny or a mole or whatever over here. So, you know, there's all those other agroecological benefits that you really only get a chance to appreciate when you're in the tractor seat or on a field. Yeah, go ahead.
I've been having a lot of, the last couple of years, I've been having a lot of trouble with native fish coming in. Does that
seem sore? I would say that this would not eradicate or retard Canadian thistle, but I don't think if it's managed properly, I don't think it's gonna, you know, increase your Canadian thistle either, because you're gonna get out there and you're gonna mow at a time before Canadian thistle would head out, but you're not going to stop the ones that are growing beneath the ground and continuing to spread out. We've had some fields that Canadian thistle did come in, primarily when we were doing, sorry Margaret, rye vetch production for Albert Lee Seed, and you know, we've had to go to, fortunately we got the beef cattle, so we just go to a sorghum mix, right? You know, there's some fertility things that we can do to help with Canadian thistle as far as mineral amendments based on soil tests and recommendations from people that are professional at that, as well as some of those, you know, cultural rotations. So we have had to go into some of those fields and do a warm season blend, multi-cut, you know, and that really has helped us a lot on the Canadian. I think it's a combination of the fact that it just simply can't compete, so it weakens that thistle, and you're doing multiple cuts, right? So, you know, the combination of those two cultural practices, along with the cultural practice, along with the just the plant architecture of the sedan, is probably what's helping us with the thistle. I think so. Yep. Yeah, I mean, we didn't get multiple cuts this year. I can on the ones that we were cleaning thistles up on. But so again, clover in the fall, not, you know, this is on Zimmer's farm, you know, not a lot of rye, not a lot of wheat. Clover in the spring. You know, that's our field as you're working it down. You know, there's a lot of biomass there. Yep. I would say it's end of August, first part of September. Again, it varies. We've done it considerably earlier because we've got a weedy field. Thistle, you know, being one of them, you know, we've got to get out there, you know, 2 weeks after we harvest, because the thistle just, you know, it did the same thing the clover did, you know, jumped as soon as the rye was out of the way. So this is clover termination on our farm. You know, there's a lot of controversy about speed discs. You know, it's been, to a large degree, it's been an invaluable tool for us to get over acres. I can tell you that it's given me more confidence to terminate and incorporate a cover crop than I probably should have had, because I've let cover crops get away from me because of it, because I thought, you know, what the hell, I got 600 horsepower, 30 some feet wide, I can kick the butt of a cover crop really easy. It does a great job. I mean, as you can see, we terminate it like that, leave it for 10 days or 2 weeks, hit it with a soil finisher and plant. But here's clover that got away from me. So you can see, to answer your question, Margaret, you know, mowing timing, this was a spring mowing in addition to the fall mowing, because the clover, there's some rye off to the right, but the clover was, I think I drove my Jeep out there and it was almost up to the top of the fender, you know, on the Jeep. And it was, it's something that you have to deal with. I mean, we had a wet spring. There was just no way that I could get out there and mechanically terminate that clover. So the only option was to get out there ahead of the termination with a mower. This is termination at Otter Creek Farm. They're running a Lemkin speed disc. You know, we didn't have as much luck with that. I really think, again, there's now, I mean, Lemkin was the first one in the country. Now there's a few others. Maybe there's a half a dozen different speed discs or variations of those types of tillage tools. The biggest thing that I went after it for is I wanted to be able to terminate and incorporate those cover crops with the least amount of depth into the soil as possible. So they when they're behaving, and they can be like children sometimes, they don't behave, but when they're behaving and you get them set right, and you pay attention to that, you know, they do a good job, terminating, you know, completely terminating, cutting crowns of the clover off and incorporating it well enough that you can, you know, start the process of preparing for planting. A couple of passes usually, like I said. We do have instances where, you know, we're looking at fields like this one. You can see some of the weeds showing up, but this was a field that we just decided we had to take out of that corn, rye, clover system for a year and put into sorghum sedan grass. But this is it still was, in my opinion, a beneficial soil building and nitrogen crop. I mean, this is a chart from Rick Clark. But, you know, you can look at that. We were taking, I don't know how tall that rye is, maybe 18, 20 inches. You know, we were, you know, according to Rick's measurements, you know, there's still 120 pounds of, or 120 units of nitrogen in that rye crop. That's on the internet. Right? You know, Rick said I could use it, but, you know, it's available in some of his presentations that are on YouTube and stuff too. But, the taking that rye crop down while it's still lush and highly digestible, you know, still has some pretty tremendous soil health benefits, and it did really set the stage for us to clean the Canadian thistle up on that field. So this is how Gary's doing most of his sampling. It's pretty common practice. You know, you just go out there, you get a clipping, take that top growth, you know, down as close to the ground as you can without getting any dirt in it, and sending it off to a lab. We've seen very similar tests. I don't want to focus too much on the individual numbers here, like fertilizer analysis, but the key part is, just tremendous amounts of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. And more importantly, because that crop's going down and it's so lush, you know, I had a company that sold things to you in the room maybe, or others at the conference. So I don't want to discourage the fact that you shouldn't be using, you know, like a tariff ad or, you know, CX1 or some of these amendments. But, you know, 5 gallons of a molasses-based, you know, foliar spray at 47% sugars, you know, is like 30, 40 pounds of sugar, you know, and that these cover crops have hundreds and hundreds of pounds of sugar, which is an energy source for soil life, right, for biology. This is off of our farm, you know, so we were, you know, in these, again, not focusing so much on those numbers. Can't remember exactly what our sugars were, but they were up, you know, well over 400 pounds. So, you know, the spring crop, this is again just all the above ground. Gary's done some great work as far as actually exhuming plants and measuring the below ground biomass as well. But, you know, we've started to just look at just what's above ground and measuring some of those things to try and get an idea of what's there. But, you know, you have the spring, you have the fall, and then you total that all up, you know, and these are the kind of numbers, you know, I think it's important to remember that obviously at, you know, almost 400 pounds of nitrogen, you're not going to see all that. You're not going to probably see half of that, you know, in your subsequent corn crop. And I'm not an expert at some of that nutrient cycling, but I do know that now, having done this for 8 years, 4 sequences, by the third sequence, at the end of 6 years, we went out and broadcast different rates of pelleted poultry litter, and everything from 0, you know, to 1 ton, to 2 tons, none of it showed up on the yield monitor. None of it. So in the 4th sequence, you know, that 8th year where we were at corn, we didn't apply any added nitrogen to the field. No poultry litter in the fall, no poultry litter in the dry box on the planter, no side dress during the crop year.
That comes off of just 2 measurements, the one that we left it in the fall and then the following spring. The stuff that grew under the dry when we have harvest dry, I didn't count that. I counted nothing below ground. And not none of that. It's all above ground nitrogen at a high digestible stage. Yeah, we're not short of nitrogen.
Right. So the goal here is to really, and then, you know, again, making sure that your soils are healthy, right? Because in order to mineralize that N, you're going to have a fully functioning soil stomach, right? That biology is going to have to be able to convert, you know, that nitrogen into a plant available form. So, you know, the combination of this intensive soil health year, the long period of no tillage, no soil disturbance, is really setting up some of those soil health parameters that, you know, again, may not be for everybody, may not be for every acre on everybody's farm, but in those instances where you want to try and build and grow your own fertility and begin to build this bank, you know, doing this kind of process every 2 years, you know, even if you're only able to mineralize 20% of that, and on my farm I proved it to myself, you eventually get to a tipping point where you can really back off poultry litter. Our farm is 19 miles away from the largest egg producer in North America, and I have a hard time getting poultry litter. 20 semi-loads a day go out of there, and I'm on a waiting list. So, you know, that was part of it. Part of it was I just didn't even like having to buy conventional poultry litter. Some of you in this room, I know Gary's farm is connected to this organic, you know, poultry operation. That's lovely. I mean, being able to bring organic poultry litter back to my farm, I probably never would have worked so hard to try and figure this out. I mean, it wouldn't happen. But, you know, if we're wanting more acres, if we're looking to, you know, through the TOP program and other things, you know, convert more acres, get more acres in under organic production, and the fact that conventional farmers have figured out that poultry litter is not only an economical source of P and K, they're not after the nitrogen, but it's an economical source of P and K, and it functions better in their soils, right? It's in a carbon biological form that just naturally is a better food for soil biology, which therefore it means it's going to be mineralized and made plant available more efficiently. So, you know, but the other part of it is I just don't like spreading stinky chicken poop, you know. We're in an area literally halfway between Milwaukee and Madison, a lot of urban sprawl, a lot of, you know, residential pressure. You know, I got fields right up next to elementary schools. I mean, there are some places that eventually, you know, certainly wet litter, I won't be able to apply it anymore. So these were the factors that went in. Obviously, there's some risks associated with that. Margaret's been very good at identifying most all of them for me relative to, you know, growing a grass on a grass and what potentially could happen and these high biomass cover crops and what could potentially happen. So, you know, there are some unknowns. They have not, and some risks that haven't shown up on our farm yet. You know, we're you know, 8 years into it, but it is certainly possible that on other farms or even on mine that some of those things could come in. So we'll see how that goes. But your crop removal numbers are about here. Again, not focusing tremendously on the numbers. One university could have a different number. Margaret probably has a different number. But the reality is that, you know, looking at those high numbers of what we're able to produce by growing our own fertility, and then the numbers that our crop removal is taking away, is giving us that net balance in our bank account that after repeats of this system, it's showing positive results from the standpoint of building a bank account of these nutrients that we can draw on appropriately and still get, you know, appreciable yields in our row crop year. So corn planting real quick, I'm not sure, I've got about 15 minutes. So again, a high residue, you know, this is on the Zimmer farm. I think Gary and Nick were probably the earliest ones to really develop, you know, running row cleaners really deep and being able to get in and plant behind these high residues. And
you don't run a time meter.
Right, right. Well, I do, but you don't, right. You know, in our system, you know, we're getting the field in our soil types, you know, our clay loam, sand loam soils, you know, we're able to do it in such a way that I can still use, you know, this is an Einbach camera-guided cultivator, which wouldn't work on Gary's farm. And I'm not saying this wouldn't work. Gary had one. It didn't work. So, the I want to be able to continue to use this, partly because I own it, and I don't want to have to change. And the other part of it is that, as you see in this picture, I mean, it does a pretty good job. You know, this is after 3 weeks of not being able to get in a field and cultivate. You can see the weeds that are coming. And, you know, between the precision of that cultivator, which I can run sweeps within 3/4 of an inch or to an inch and a half away from the stem of the plant, along with the feeder weeders, you know, finger weeders at 5.5-6 miles an hour, I don't want to lose that weed control option. That's just on my farm. But again, those are some of the differences. They both work. I have exactly the same amount of residue, but part of the reason why I'm not harvesting my corn until after Thanksgiving is because I don't get it planted as early as in the other system, right? So, I mean, that's the give and take. You know, so I'll probably go to a 88-day corn instead of a 95, you know, and try and manage that so I can still have the time to digest those residues and manage them. We're way better than we were originally as soon as those fields are fit, we get out there and terminate the clover. Initially, it was like, oh, let it grow another week, you know, oh, let it grow another week. I want more nitrogen. I want more all the lovely stuff that it's doing. And it bit us in the hinder every time we did that. So, you know, we learned through that mistake. And now, in some instances, on some of the heavier fields, we've actually gone in and dinged it in the fall. You know, practically running the speed disc without the blades engaged in the ground, but just enough to sort of set that clover back. And we're looking at some other lighter vertical tillage tools to potentially just, you know, manage that clover in a way that it's not going to, if we get that wet spring and it gets away from us like that picture I showed you, that we might be better off having the duality of not only the requirement, the rescue of mowing it, but also the ability to potentially set the stage for not having that become as big a problem if we get that clover dinged in the fall. That's actually Leo Einbach.
seen my farm, and I said, can I take that cullet off my cornfield? He said, absolutely not. He saw my residue. He said, get out there, no more tillage. I said, nope, cultivator leaves.
So yeah, this is Otter Creek. You know, they're running Buffalo, like the Buffalo works really well. Single sweep works really well in that high residue, and in the soils that they have and the system that they're using. Not that either one of these two. Gary might tell you his is better, but not that either of the two are one's better than the other. It's got to be what really works, you know, for you in your soils on your farm and in. What's that? That's 30 inch.
Is it 30?
Yep. Yeah, and this was 30 as well. But you talk about tight. Leo's here. When I originally had that set up, you know, we had angle knife blades, and they were set, I don't know, maybe 4 inches apart. So 2 inches from a corn plant that was a half an inch in diameter. So less than 2 inches from a corn plant. And in a strong Austrian accent, he says, why so wide? And I'm like, what? So he's literally out there with his own tools and gloves, and Martin on the left, Leo on the right, and they're bringing those shovels from 4 inches, you know, down to almost two. I sweated a little bit when we went back to combining corn.
No hillsides or curves.
Exactly, no hillsides, no curves. You know, we don't plant headlands. I've got a couple of slides. I may not get to those, but we don't plant headlands. We leave the clover grow, and they become these. Pollinator habitats as they flower in their second year. So there's a number of things that we're able to make rectangles out of the fields pretty easy. Yes, sir.
And there's no way to get away from cultivating planting corn.
Then. There's people that are working at it. You know, there's people with organic herbicides. There's people that are looking at no-till or minimum-till options, similar to like rolly crimping soybeans. I've tried a lot of that, you know. I mean, trust me, I've tried a lot of that, and you know, it's just it. I for me on my farm, I haven't been able to. I'll do it for 2 years, and then I'll have like a complete disaster, complete crop failure.
You go to strip till that clover, and then take them back either on my mower, row mower, and then blow the regrowth of the clover into the row to mulch the row. That'll give you more nutrients.
Well, and we are working with a company, and I have an NDA with them, and we're looking at building a machine, you know, that would do this undercutting, because it wouldn't be a full strip till with a shank, and then this mowing, you know, sort of a intercropping, you know, a perennial intercropping system. If they ask me to come back, I'll probably have those slides next year or the year after or whenever. But I think there are ways to do that and to further minimize tillage. But again, in this system, we're already giving that 18-month rest. And I don't feel that shallow incorporation of crop residues and running these cultivators, you know, an inch and a half into the soil and managing it in this way, and with the high infiltration rates, you know, Gary and I are part of a program where they're sending out people and they're counting bugs and birds and water infiltration rates and everything else. You know, not this field, but on average, the fields that they're testing through that system has 20 times more water infiltration than the state of Wisconsin average. And that field that I showed you that was in conventional corn that had hardly a tire track in it, the field right across from it that was farmed exactly the same way 3 years ago, in just 3 years it has 250 times more water infiltration than that field. So, you know, yes, I'm not on slopes, I don't have a lot of hills, pretty flat ground, got soils that are able to take those rain events for the most part. So again, in context, if you're on hills, you're on slopes, you know, some of these things, to your question of looking at ways to even further reduce tillage, are all good stuff.
So you're doing the blind cultivation or some tine weeding or something before?
Yeah, we have both rotary hoe, you know, 30-foot rotary hoe and a 30-foot tine weeder. Tine weeding is one of those things that the ground conditions as well as the red. I mean, there's years that that I don't pull the tine weeder out of the because I can't. I mean, it's not going to work, right? I mean, the soil's too wet, you know, the conditions, but I got to get in and do some sort of blind cultivation or even post-emergence rotary hoe. And a rotary hoe will work in those wetter soil conditions where, you know, tine weeders, you know, the people that build those primarily in Europe will tell you, you know, if you don't see dust flying behind the tine weeder, go park it and, you know, get your rotary hoe out because you're not doing what you need to do, you know. You know, the effectiveness of that tool And the terminology that Leo always used was referring to it as dust mulching. You know, so in Europe, they're trying to do this very shallow, repetitive soil disturbance cultivation until they create a soil differentiation and a stratification between this really dry, dusty layer and the soil below it. It ends up becoming a mulch. So you've broken that ability for the soil to transpire moisture to the surface and then lose it. But you've also taken that primary zone where weed seeds germinate, that top inch and a half, and you've made it either inhospitable or less hospitable to a weed seed to germinate. So that's the theory behind that process. And it, residues like around the Otter Creek farm or not, a tine weeder isn't going to work all the time. So it's not, you know, there, if there was a silver bullet down on the exhibit floor, none of you'd be in here. You know, I'd be down there with you, right? I mean, sign me up, you know. It was interesting, I did this Blue River Viking trial, and it's now one company. So I don't have to do that. I don't have to do those anymore. But I did this mainly just to show you that what we're doing with the headlands. You know, we may change that a little bit. We've gone, finally, you know, graduated to, instead of running 2 6-row planters to a 12-row planter. You know, we may start working some of those, but by the time you go through with your cultivation passes, you know, we do continue to spray liquid biologicals. We were going through and doing side dress poultry litter pellets, which we're not anymore. You run so much down in a headland that, you know, weeds became a problem because we opened up the canopy of those corn plants that, in a way that we couldn't manage the weeds in them. And we weren't really, between the compaction and everything else, we really weren't getting the yields there. So it just seemed to work better to have, we take those headlands back in the rye year. You know, we take them out and plant rye in them, so we get those acres back on the small grain or the solid seeded year. But we're not planting into them with the corn year. That's what the headland looks like. You know, second year, you know, it's coming on pretty strong. That's corn harvest on that same field. I tried to use it so that you could really kind of get the similar perspective. That was the first year certified corn. The rye was certified. Organic the year before, and it was in alfalfa for the 2 years prior to that, managed organically, but still fed to the conventional cows. Corn harvest, that's Taliesin in the background, Holland. This was the field that I'm sort of most proud of, because this is the one that was the result of four sequences of rye, clover, corn. You know, that field averaged a little over 200 bushels an acre, and there, you know, we did have a starter fertilizer. So full disclosure, you know, MBA made that fertilizer, Midwestern BioAg, and they did use poultry crumbles to as a carrier for my nutrient blend. So we did have 12 pounds of nitrogen applied. So it wasn't a zero nitrogen trial, but it was as close to zero as you're ever going to get. So that's the, you know, that's the goal, in at least on my farm and in my system, is to try and get it where we can have disease-free, weed-free, and the limited amount, minimum amount, potentially, you know, no inputs from a nitrogen standpoint, you know, off-farm nitrogen. We're still going to have to balance fertility. We're still shipping nutrients off the farm. You know, we're always putting the nutrients that get away from our farm and others every year. You know, sulfur, boron, some of those things. We're still dealing with soil correctives on some of these farms. You know, typical goal, right, 70 to 75% base saturation calcium. That farm that I showed you with the no tire track in it was 43% base saturation calcium. It's gonna cost $1,000-$1,500 an acre to fix that farm. All of that, and some time. You know, it's not gonna just happen overnight, but, so though, you know, that sort of starting point, you know, that farm, and this is the other end of the rainbow for me. And, you know, I'm going to put these in a spreadsheet where it'll be a little bit easier to see them. We are doing some deep ripping. Otter Creek's doing the same. Areas of compaction, you know, heavy rains, potentially harvest time, headlands, and certainly those fields that I'm transitioning, you know, we're at least going in there and doing it once. But we're finding that after a period of time, just like any organic transition field, you know, if we could, if hopefully we'll get to a point where we're not transitioning any more acres and there'll be somebody else to do that, you know, it, we'll sell that, you know, we'll get rid of that.
And that field would, we graze that cover crop in here. And then the certain cows out here would graze an inch and a half at 3 o'clock in the morning. That's why we ran this inline drift call.
So I got about 5 minutes left here. I'll run through these slides quick. There are going to be there will be access to these this presentation and all others. I mean, Marble Seed's going to send you an email with a link. Any of the programs that you did go to and you wanted to see again, any of them that you didn't see that you wanted to see, and certainly this one will be available for you to scroll through. You know, once they send you, you know, compile all that and send you that email. So if I go through these a little quick, or if you question or challenge any of them, my phone and email is at the end, and the presentations will be online. So we're going real quick. Obviously, this slide needs to be changed, right? It's no longer $10 a bushel corn, right? But you know, sort of using it for the sake of ease of math, running that rye year with the intention, of not making a lot of money, but making a lot of nitrogen and offsetting the need to spend that money in the corn year. You know, these are the gross revenues. You know, we're looking, if we can stay at 175 bushels, and the 175 bushels is taking into account those headlands that we don't plant. So we take, you know, just like a crop would, right? We take a whole 40-acre field, and if we take out 2 acres or 3 acres for headlands, you know, they're gonna only look at the corn that was grown on it. So we're taking the headlands out in that scenario. This is a high end where we're putting a couple tons of poultry litter on, but still, even in that scenario, at $10 corn, which it's not now, but I didn't want to depress you by putting $6.50 in there. So the reality is that we're still on both years, average over those 2 years, we're still, you know, net revenue of about $500 an acre. If we go to the, and this is when we were using a lot of poultry litter, if we go to the low end situation, same numbers in yield, same numbers on crop prices, you know, we pick up, you know, another $230 an acre per year, you know, in that scenario. So again, you know, these prices need to be adjusted every 2 weeks, right? I mean, it changes a lot. But from the standpoint of demonstrating the value, I don't think that poultry litter is going to get any cheaper. It's not going to get any easier to haul. It's not going to get any more fun to spread. So, you know, figuring out ways to do as little of that as possible. Some people have access to their own dairy or hog manure or their own poultry, you know, manure or other options. But for me, you know, that's where we're going. This is a similar lineup, same crop prices, you know, similar costs associated, you know, with what they were figuring on some of those slides earlier. You saw, you know, some of what I was figuring as far as cost per acre to make a pass or haul a bushel of corn. One of the things that I did on mine, just so you know, is that, you know, these, we don't have enough bin space, so half to three quarters of our corn gets hauled to Caxton. You know, so we have a much higher, you know, cost per bushel transportation, you know, than Otter Creek does when they do have the bin space, and they have, when they do have to truck it, you know, it's in country terms right around the corner. You know, so there's other factors that are, you know, really, if you go to look under the hood, and if anybody wanted to take a look at, I'm always free to like literally share my enterprise budget. So if you wanted to look at the Excel spreadsheet with all the minutiae of every little detail, you know, I'll send you a PDF of it if you ask me to, not a problem. So remember, context, right? Always context, context, context. This one I thought was really good. Any Bandit, you know, Smokey and the Bandit fans here? I had a stint as a truck driver, so I always liked it. But yeah, you know, when you tell somebody something, it depends on what part of the United States you're in, you're standing in, as to how dumb you are. So, you know, I want to just try and make sure, and it's not a cover my ass situation, but I want to make sure that depending on the geography and where from around the country you guys are coming, that you really understand that this system is not a tried and true university tested system. It's a couple of farmers that are hanging 10 on their surfboards, you know, and we're trying it. And obviously it really matters. This is one of Gary's slides. You know, you can lead a farmer to knowledge, but you can't make him think. But the other part for me in looking at that slide is, and what I've always challenged myself to do on my own farm, and I know a lot of you do as well, is, you know, really get out on your farm, become your own expert. You know, really look at your fields, really challenge yourself. You know, take the rose-colored glasses off, you know, and put some magnifiers on and really see what's happening on your farm. And I think I got it right at time. There you go. I think we may have a few minutes for questions. Yes, sir.
I'm thinking about this with other crops.
Mm-hmm.
Being a vegetable person. When do you all suspect you're seeing that flush of nitrogen from the clover? How many weeks after turn one? And for a corn crop, you've got a lot of time to capture that. But for a veg crop, potentially, it would matter if that veg crop was shorter days to maturity.
Yeah, I think that there's probably a lot of data out there as far as what that is, but I think it also, back to that context thing, it really depends on what type of soil you're in, what moisture, what temperature zone you're in. So I'm not trying to avoid your question, but one of the factors that I know about how that digests and how it slow releases nitrogen is, you know, some, you know, highly digestible and soluble as you take it down, early available, others, you know, begin, you know, biology. Yeah, and biology warming up gives you another bump. You know, later on you get some additional mineralization. So having a bank of last year's nitrogen and the nitrogen from 2 years ago that is also sequencing through these nitrogen pools at different amounts, the soil is not going to be able to dish out something that isn't there, whether that's minerals, right? You know, or whether that's nitrogen, right? So having, in my mind, my simple mind, having the bank account with which to draw from ensures that there's pools of nitrogen that are going to be able to manage these fluxes and flows of availability. It doesn't answer your question for a vegetable crop, but again, if you were vegetable bed, you know, a lot of vegetable farms I would run, they would sort of fallow or soil build 1 year, kind of this program in a vegetable system. They'd farm like maybe half their farm, and really, because the actual vegetable production is so intense, that I would think that this system, you know, you'd have an opportunity to put other cover crops in there as well, peas, you know, oats. Yeah, I mean, my other slide had sort of the mixture that we started with, you know, medium red, all psych, sweet clover, you know, and again, those have different root architectures. What's that?
None of the short whites.
I think we had some whites in there at one time. I think the whites, at least on my farm, were what disappeared in the winter, you know, but again, you know, I went to the you know, I'm going to just make sure that it all survives and I only have to mow it once mammoth route. And we've now, the mix that I got from Edwin up in Canada this year is a blend of his, what he calls vernal alfalfa. It's sort of just a, you know, an alfalfa they've been growing on their farm since the 20s, a medium and a mammoth. So we're trying, you know, and it's sort of a tap rooted alfalfa. So I'll get that deeper alfalfa. He feels it's going to stand up to the two clovers pretty well. We'll see how it goes, but. The idea again is find the clover mix that works on your farm, overwinters and is highly productive. I think that if you can add diversity to it and get different root, you know, agronomics, even the better. But you know, it's right now in this system, it's all about the nitrogen production. So, yep.
You're not taking any straw off after you.
Nope.
As far as the fertility amounts, if a guy wanted to take the crop straw.
Well, those numbers that Gary and I had from our measurements don't include the straw. We didn't add that summer clipping in.
You're just spreading the straw back out there, right?
Spread the straw, and then
the straw
and then
is the
straw's there. It's not there the following year. It's gone. It's been all digested, yeah.
But, I mean, it's back up in plant.
Some of it, yep. I like using the deep roots of the rye almost like a well or a pump. And if I'm going to bring those nutrients from a deep lens of soil that my corn root is not, or sunflower root's not going to access, I want to leave those nutrients, you know, relocated from a deeper lens of soil up to the surface and have that rye digested and be bringing those nutrients through the system utilizing that deep rooting rye. And When I look at a test of what a bale of straw has in it from nutrients, I can't, at least in my market, I don't know where everybody, but I cannot charge enough for the bale of straw to buy those nutrients back that I ship off. And I know that they're gonna come in the form of rock dusts and stuff that's not gonna be nearly as plant available as the straw was.
And I think the other thing is that we need an exorcist, you know, down Lundgren's test, and if my fungal and bacteria right here, oh, you're so bacteria down. So I hate to tell people that the plant puts down excess feed bacteria. The plant wants to be bacteria down, but we, our numbers are really high. I know yours is the same. Mm-hmm. Our fungal bacteria ratios are really, really good. But how did the straw get out yet? That's the only mature root going in the ground. The October is only a year old.
Yeah, you want those, again, from my composting background, and, you know, I was in the livestock business as a composter in my mind, right? I was feeding huge mounds of microscopic, you know, that was a herd of workers that were doing those things for me. So you want some of that lignified residue out there. You know, if you don't want, you know, none of us would survive on a bowl of ice cream at three meals a day, right? So we want the soil, it wants that, it requires, needs, benefits from that same diversity. And I just don't think, again, in my systems, running my numbers, in my mind, in my experience, that I could be financially rewarded enough for selling the straw, along with the workload, right? I mean, I have a workload management, so I don't have to cut it, I don't have to windrow it, I don't have to bale it, I don't have to haul it off the field, I don't have to store it in a shed, so it's, you know, until somebody wants to buy it, I don't have to worry about this check is good when I sell it. You know, all that stuff is off the table as well if I just feed it to the soil. Feed it to the soil.
How tall is that clover when you top the rye?
I'll tell you this August. It varies. It, you know, the growing season, the types of clover mixes. Right. 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 Yep.
When you choose to go in and rip, when do you prefer to do that and how deep are you going?
We're going in the fall as dry as we can. You know, again, I want that fracturing. If I pull the ripper out of the ground and there's soil that's adhering to it or smeared to it, or if I pull anything that's attached to it and I can roll it up, like a pasta in my hand, you know, we try and stay away from it. And you know, we run as deep as we can. Speed in that situation also has a factor. You know, I think that, and slow isn't necessarily bad, right? You know, so you have to manage, because, you know, we really want to try and, we have wings on the ripper, we really want to try and get in and lift the, we're not trying to make that groove in the soil thinking that water and roots are going to go down that groove. I want to take that hard compacted soil and lift it between two shanks and then drop it back down again, like you see the guys breaking up the concrete on the highways, and shatter that entire profile of soil, not just run slots in it. And if you get too wet, in my experience, all you're doing is just making notches in the soil and you're not really fracturing it.
And that's why we put yellow blossom sweet clover in our mix down. We tried alfalfa because it didn't compete very well. We're trying to eliminate that. We didn't do any the last 2 years in dry. Those wet years is when we ran that ripper. When the cows were up, we ran the ripper. We only do 10% of our land with the ripper. That's why we're trying to adapt to keep it reversed. That's where the sweet clover came in. Whether we'll curse it later or not, I'll tell you.
Yeah. Not tiled. No, we're not tiled.
You guys no tile?
No tile.
Sand, man.
Yeah, and we're glaciated where we're at, so most of our fields are sand loams. I mean, and I shouldn't say most of them are that. I mean, you look at a soil map, there's 12 or 15 different soil types in a 100-acre field, right? Because it's just all mashed up by the glaciers. But pretty consistently, underneath whatever soil I do have, I have a clay cap and then glacial till below that. So, you know, we're slow draining. I wouldn't say we're free draining, but you know, we're in a pretty good, you know, other than the hilltops and knolls that got farmed off years ago and blew away or ran away. I don't want any tile. I don't want any tile. I don't think, you know, at least in my farm, on my farm, tile's not necessary. And I don't particularly care for concentrated flow, right? And, you know, I think it'll only be a matter of time that somebody's at the end of a tile going to a ditch on an organic farm. And we talk about, oh, you know, all those conventional farmers with that highly soluble liquid nitrogen, that's what's making that dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. Well, you get all this highly digestible clover and you melt it down and you get that biology going and you get a nitrate release and a 3-inch rain. I'm sorry, your tile might look just as bad as your neighbor's. So I don't want any part of it. You know, sorry for that position, but I don't. Yes?
I see the only reason or risk analysis for that is just the open-end distillery in the rye.
No, I would.
If you're all looking to get rid of
it. Yeah, I mean, right. So right now, I mean, I didn't spend a lot of time on that slide, you know, with the dot, each dot being 25,000 bushels. Right now, the United States, current USDA statistics, we're using about 22 million bushels of rye. About half of that is imported. So the low-hanging fruit for us as farmers in the United States, conventional, organic, or anywhere in between, is to grow those 11 million bushels. And that goes to milling, Bay State milling, rye flour, rye bread, pumpernickel breads, you know, pastrami sandwiches. Yeah, and I mean, some people will tell you that a loaf of bread is just a bunch of grain that missed out on becoming whiskey, right? So, you know, it depends on where you are, if you're a baker or a distiller, you know, if you drink or you don't. And obviously there's some concerns about that, but no, where the real piece of rye markets could potentially be is a return to at least a modest human consumption. Gary was in Poland last summer. They eat like 140 pounds of rye per capita. We eat 0.7 pounds or 0.4 or something like that. And then the other piece is animal diets. You know, rye has phytocompounds, nutritional factors, high digestible fiber that support, you know, our gut health and our immune system health. It does the same thing for a pig, a cow, a sheep, a goat, you know. And that's why, you know, we grew so much rye pre-corn, you know. At the time that, in 1919, that slide, rye probably was as many bushels an acre as corn was. You know, and it was easier to grow. It grew in the winter, less weeds, you know, cows liked it, whatever. And it, you know, a lot of those people. Yeah. So.
The cover crops right now is in Virginia. They get between $65 and $90 a acre to grow a cover crop. Minnesota, I did meetings for the Soil Conservation Service across Minnesota, and they're getting between that $50 minimum in Holmes County, which is by Rochester, that's $90 a acre to grow that cover crop. And they have to take a class on soil health. So there'll be a lot of acres of cover crops.
Well, and the other part that's not factored in there, you go down to Farmers for Soil Health in the thing, or you go to the DeLong program, all this, you know, climate, Grown Climate Smart Initiative, Climate Smart Commodities, they're paying you $50 for that fall cover crop, and then they'll pay you another $50 for a spring cover crop. And I've said, this is my production system. These are going to be harvested for grain. They're going to be left there for nitrogen. They're paying me $100 an acre. It wasn't even factored in there because I don't know how long it's going to last. I'm not going to count on it. But some of these cover crop incentives, they're actually, you know, local watershed groups and stuff are paying people to plant rye in the fall. And if the caveat is I can terminate it in the spring, which I have, as a cover crop and plant something else, or I take it to grain, and they're like, all we want is the root in the ground over the winter, and they're in the early spring when the soils are super susceptible, you know, we'll pay you. I mean, you're basically getting paid to plant, you know, it cost me about $45 an acre according to the numbers I put up there to put the clover out there. You know, maybe $50-$55 an acre for the rye. I mean, right now, because of the cover crop incentives and because I was doing something that they want everybody else to do, they're willing to pay me $50 an acre to do it twice. So, and I don't, you know, those climate smart commodities things are, you know, millions and millions of dollars, you know, for 3 years or 5 years or whatever. And the hope is that's going to demonstrate a need to potentially permanently into the farm. But if it disappears in 3 or 5 years, that's why it's not on my, you know, I mean, I'll see government money. Oh, well, I didn't, you know, I mean, you could be, you know, Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, and I'm sure they wouldn't like me promoting rye, right, and whiskey, so.
Right, exactly.
And they would have a valid point, right? Yep. Anything else?
Are your panels certified organic?
They are not. They're on certified organic pastures, and we put them there mainly because I was waiting for a market to put cows back in at the dairy. And that market hasn't come back yet, so the herd's like big now, growing big.
So ROC will still certify you if you have non-organic cattle with organic.
As long as I'm not trying to ROC certify the beef, they don't have a problem with that.
That's interesting.
Yep. I mean, they went out and inspected it like they were going to ROC the cattle. They made sure I had, you know, the shade, the water, the infrastructure, you know, all the things that if they were going to ROC certify it. So if I was like, oh, no, we can't go out and look at the cows, you know, they're this deep and they're panting and they're, you know, whatever, they would want to know that. But I didn't. We have not chosen to go the organic certification route. We have a on-farm store. I sell, you know, 2 or 3 beef a month, you know, just through the store. And the organic certification just was another level of complexity that, I mean, I buy a lot of stockers and young stock from an organic dairy farm, so it'd be super easy to certify them. But, you know, the market right now isn't demanding that, so I'm not doing it.
What else do you sell in here? Or is it just beef?
Primarily just beef, and then we use the market to bring in vegetables and some other stuff from other farms around the state. We have, you know, Meadowlark's flour, which is kind of cool because some of my grain goes there and then gets milled and comes back and stuff. But the only thing that we actually like raise 100% is the beef.
Yeah.
Oh, you go right past Stonebank Farm Market. Yeah, you do. Yeah, it's a nice little store. Really, really good events there as well from an education standpoint. It's not the greatest spot. You know, it's off the beaten path. I can probably shut this off.